Introduce our main speaker for this evening, April M. from Escondido.
Great Plow Clock, my name is April.
Hi, April.
Hi, you guys. My sobriety date is September 24th, 1989, and my sponsor is Michaeline F. from Escondido, and my home group is the Sunday Morning Paper. So we do our deal on Valley Parkway at 9 o'clock. We're in the schedule Sunday morning. If you feel like joining us, come on up. So, I had a really great pitch for you guys tonight, and then I saw that Pam is here, and she's my sober sister and probably my best friend, so I'm going to have to tell my story because I was going to tell you some other one, but I was so upset when I saw her. I love being sober. I love being sober. It's the best thing about me. It's the best thing about my life. I'm from Escondido, like really from Escondido. I was born there, raised there, and have tried to escape twice, and I keep having to come back because Escondido sucks. So I just get drawn back in. Actually, as far as I'm concerned, I've been to meetings all over the world and some of the best sobriety all over the places in Escondido, California. So I love it there. Welcome to the newcomers, and welcome to our visitors from out of town. There's some people from far away here. I hope you love San Diego. We got a real good thing going here. This is what some people refer to as pockets of enthusiasm, and this is one of them. So, tell you a little bit about me. I don't come from a really messed up background or a messed up family or anything like that. I had a very nice family. I mean, I have nice brothers and sisters. I have nice parents. They're still married. They've been married for 63 years. It was a really nice, normal, healthy family. The only thing that was wrong with it is I was in it. I am the dysfunctional part of my family, and I can tell you that I was just off from day one, as far back as I can remember. I mean, there was just something wrong with April, and they talked about it, and I don't think they listening to him talk about it. Oh, that was great. And, you know, it was just like, what are we going to do about April? I mean, there was just something not quite right. I was like way before alcohol. And, I mean, like, almost like a little deviant. And I don't think I meant to be that way. I think I just thought I was really curious about stuff. I think normal kids, they look at a warning label on something and they see it as a warning. Warning labels pique my interest. Basically, if it says keep away from fire or flame, I got to know what happens if you light it. I mean, why did they say don't? Yeah, don't puncture, incinerate, where's my brother's BB gun? Yeah, it's not trying to be bad, it's just, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time, and that's going to be the story of my life. And there's me, and a lot of trouble for my parents. I will say right now that I've actually been blessed the last couple of years to have an opportunity to care for my parents. My dad has late stage Alzheimer's and my mom has dementia. And I have been enabled in the last couple of years to make some amends that were long overdue. Because I terrorized that family. And I had everything going for me except for that I was me. I grew up going to church. I have nothing bad to say about that experience except for that I was there. And I have alcoholism. And I would sit in church and I would hear people talk about God, and it would come through this weird alcoholic filter that I have in my brain. And by the time it registered with me, it was something like really scary, really bad, like not even good. And by the time I was 8 years old, God was the boogeyman. And by the time I was 12, I'm done, I'm moving on, and not going to go back. And then, you know, I mean, trouble in school, trouble getting in fights, just problems. And then I went off to junior high school, and something really important happened. Things were about to change for me. December 29th, 1973, red letter day in my life. I got drunk for the first time. And I can't tell you the first time I ever had tacos. I can't tell you the day I graduated high school. I can't tell you the day I had sex for the first time, but I can tell you the time I got drunk the first time. And it was not my first drink. I'm Irish. We drink. You know, your kids are allowed to drink if you're Irish. But I'd never had enough to drink. And on this particular day, I had my very own bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. Paid a dollar for it. It was a dollar to get loaded in 1973. And so it's my own bottle, and I can drink as much of it as I want. And now, here's what I planned on doing that day. I knew I was going to get drunk. I'd seen drunk. I mean, I'm Irish, right? And drunk looked fun. Drunk looked wild. It looked really, really interesting. There was something kind of rebellious about it. There were so many things about it that appealed to me. And I was going to now be hanging out with the cool older kids in the neighborhood. I mean, this is just like going to be a good deal, right? And it was all of those things and something else. Because I have alcoholism. And there's something different that happens to alcoholics when we drink alcohol that doesn't happen to them. Not them out there. It happens to us, doesn't happen to them. I've interviewed them at length, and it doesn't happen. Trust me. They fascinate me. So what I discovered besides drunk was that about this far through a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, you guys, it was like all the tumblers clicked into place, and I had the combination, and the air was turned on, and the color was bright. I mean, it's just like the best thing about having about three drinks in you is you like me better. I was sure of it, you know. I woke up that morning like I woke up every morning, just, you know, obnoxious, just kind of a crummy person. And I knew that, and I knew that you thought that. And something about three drinks of alcohol, your opinion of me changes vastly. And my opinion of you changes a lot, too. I mean, it just seems to make everything right. Problem is, there's a catch. I have alcoholism, which means I'm not going to stop at three drinks. I don't stop at three drinks. I'm going to keep on going. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm off in the bushes somewhere throwing up a lot. And this is not a deterrent. Because for a couple hours there on that Saturday afternoon, I was the best I'd ever been in my life. I was the best me I'd ever been. I mean, I reached my full potential for a minute there. And the next day I was bad hungover, took the day off, but I'd made a very important discovery that what had been wrong with me all my life is I'd been sober. That's what's wrong, because I mean, I was just great when I had the alcohol in me. So I took that day off, and then I drank again New Year's Eve and went into my first blackout. Now, I'd never had a blackout before. It's kind of like time travel, you know. I woke up the next morning, and I had dried vomit in my hair, and I was wearing somebody else's chonies, and I can't remember several hours of the... I mean, I can remember sitting there, and then I'm, you know, on the floor, and it's morning and stuff. And because I've never had a blackout, I didn't know to not ask. So I asked, what happened last night? And I've learned since then, you don't want to know what happened last night because it wasn't good. I don't care what, never once in my life, you know, have I been in a blackout and it's like, oh, thank God you were there, April. You know, like, you really, wow, you were great. It's humiliating, shameful. I owe somebody an apology. Count on it. So I asked on that day, and I never asked again since. In fact, by the time I was about 14, 15 years old, I discovered that if somebody asks you, because they ask you, do you know what you did last night? Did you guys get that thing in your stomach that just happened? Right? Where it's like fear. You go, oh, what? So if you just say, yeah, with that little head bob thing, yeah, they don't tell you. So if you're going to get drunk again and you go into a blackout, that's, you know, let me be helpful to you and just say, you know, yeah. And they won't tell you what happened, because if you're like me, it's not good. And so I'm off and running. And I liked anything that gave me a head change, anything. I liked all kinds of dry goods. They're part of my story. And I could not wait to try the next thing. And I was off and running. Now, this kind of a thing was perfect for somebody who was a problem anyways, And now I'm going to be a quantum problem. And, you know, my poor parents. I got arrested a lot. I got in fights a lot. And, I mean, there's just certain things that you're good at, and those were the things I was good at. And I wasn't very, I mean, I wasn't good in school, but I was a good fighter. So, I mean, I got that going for me. And, just in trouble a lot. And I didn't really care about what that was like for anybody else. You know, certainly not my parents or my family or anything like that. I embarrassed them. I humiliated them. I brought shame on them. And I didn't care. I didn't care until I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, got sober, and started looking at that ninth step. And I started caring. Anyways, a lot of trouble, a lot of problems. Ended up getting kicked out of California for a minute. It's weird what you're proud of when you're a teenager, but I got arrested 12 times in 2 weeks, and I would proudly tell my friends this, because when you're 15 and you get arrested, nothing really happens. They put you in a holding cell, and then your big sister has to get up in the middle of the night and come get you. You know, what's the big deal? Maybe a sandwich is involved. And so that's what would happen, and that happened 11 times. And then one day they brought me a sandwich, and then they brought me another sandwich, and they brought me another sandwich, and probably another sandwich. And I'm just, you know, I'm no genius or anything like that, but I'm thinking I've probably been here more than a couple of hours. There's no clocks in here. There's no, you can't see outside or anything like that. And what was wrong is that they'd actually done a little bit of checking and found out that sister that had been picking me up wasn't my legal guardian. In fact, my legal guardians had moved to Nebraska a few months earlier, and because I was a chronic runaway, they couldn't find me. They hadn't seen me in probably about 4 months, and my dad's from Nebraska. I'm not from Nebraska. I want to make sure everybody knows that. Okay. California. And he wanted to move home, and they couldn't find me, so they just went. So police contacted him back there, and is it too late to say, long story short? Yeah, it is. So Mom and Dad had to drive back from Nebraska to get me out of jail. They were not happy about it. I was also told, they were told that if I stayed in California, I was going to be in the California Youth Authority until I was 18, or, box number two, you can go to Nebraska. I'd been to Nebraska. You got to think about that. You know, if you've ever been to Nebraska, it's like, oh my God, what are you going to do in Nebraska? Drop acid and watch the crops fail. It's just like, no. So I went to Nebraska, and I got out of there as quick as I could. And you know what? I really don't have anything bad to say about Nebraska. I don't have anything bad to say about the Midwest. I mean, I lived in a couple of states there for a minute, and, man, good people. A little odd, but good people, you know? Couldn't wait to get back. So I come back to California just before I turned 18. And right after I turned 18, I picked up another little charge. I got in a little fight, so I picked up a little assault charge. And it's different when you're 18 than it is when you're 15. Now they're talking about things like probation and fines and jail time and all that stuff. It's like, oh, really? So my next plan was I got to do something different. So my version of something different was find a guy. And the guy that I found kind of had his stuff together a little bit, or he was trying to get his stuff together. He was a thug and a criminal, which made him attractive and appealing to me, but he was also one who was kind of trying to get out of that lifestyle a little bit. I mean, he'd been incarcerated probably half of his life, but he wasn't a partier. He didn't drink, he didn't use, he didn't party, anything like that, and I find out later on that he's codependent. But didn't have a name for it then. I just thought he was awesome. And when I got in trouble, he fixed it. He got me out of whatever I got into. He put up with anything I dished out. And that's who I was going to hook up with for the next 10 years. And he just kind of enabled and took care of everything. And almost killed me. So one of the business ventures that we got into was we started growing marijuana. We'd done a whole lot of other stuff too, but we started growing marijuana because I didn't like pot. I'd rather have the flu than be stoned on pot. And it's actually the first dry good that I stopped liking. And because of that, we could actually make a profit. If I had tried to be a cocktail waitress or a bartender or sell cocaine or something like that, I wouldn't have made a dime. But this was, we're in. And so we started growing weed, selling weed, and we made a lot of money. Did real well with that. Bought nice things, bought homes, bought cars, just having a large time. And I'm running around like crazy. And he's taking care of business, and he's staying home. I mean, you can't leave the house alone because there's scummy people that come by to pick up. But I'm out running around. And pretty much did whatever I want. And I wasn't a daily drinker. But when I drank, here's what would happen. I would have a plan that I'm just going to have a couple of beers with an enchilada, right? Because it goes with Corona, right? I'm just going to have a couple of beers. I'll be home by 5. So I have a couple of beers, and for me, the phenomenon of craving kicks in. I don't know that until I'm in AA, but the phenomenon of craving kicks in. And those couple of beers are now turning into, let's go get a case, and then after the case is gone, we're getting some hard alcohol. I'm over at the ATM getting as much as I can out tonight, and I'm over at the Connections house, and I'm probably not going to be home tonight. And I planned on being home by 5. So sometimes I was going to be home in the wee hours of the morning, and sometimes I was going to be gone for a couple of days. I never knew. He never knew. The promise was always, I'll be home in a few hours. Rarely the case. And this guy put up with it, but he would ask the stupid question when I would finally get home. He would say, why don't you just call? Can't you just pick up the phone and call and let me know you're not coming back? And, you know, do you know the answer to that? No, nobody knows the answer to that. But what I would do is I would promptly make it his fault. You know, I don't call because you're a dick. I don't call because, you know, I was mad at you. I don't call because you'll probably try and get me to come home or whatever. And one morning, and I don't remember this until I'm actually doing a first step in AA, but one morning he asked me, why don't you just call? And I told the truth. I said, I don't know, Tom. It's weird. It's just like, I get a couple beers in me, and I don't give a shit about you anymore. Now, I never said that ever again. And, in fact, I denied it later. But that was actually the truth. I get a couple of drinks in me, and I don't care about anything but more drinks. That's what I care about. So some times I'll be home, and some days it's going to be, you know, a whole weekend I'm off and running. And this went on for years and years and years. And as I was saying, you know, we were growing and selling marijuana. And we ran into a little bit of a snag with that. We wanted to go to Maui, and we can't go to Maui because we can't leave the house. So I had a great idea. I thought, let's get a burglar alarm. We'll just have the alarm go off. I mean, we won't have it like hooked up to notify the police department. We just want the loud noise, and it'll chase the burglar away if somebody comes to rip us off, right? And so it seemed like a good idea, and it was. And we went to Maui, and we had a great time, and it was a great idea for about 3 weeks. And then one night we went off to the movies. Now we're able to go do all kinds of stuff. Actually, he's able to leave the house now. Went to the movies, come home, come pulling up to the house. And as we get up to the top of the driveway, we park, we're laughing, we're having a good time. And next thing you know, there's all these police jumping out of the bushes and stuff. And they got guns drawn. They're like, get out of the car, put your hands on the hood. We had just been to see Beverly Hills Cop. So, I mean, we laughed. We just thought, you know, they meant it. And so what happened is I hadn't closed the door properly, and 5 minutes later, the alarm went off after we left, and my good next-door neighbor called the cops. So the cops came to get the burglar, and while the door was ajar, and they walked in, and they started looking around for the burglar, they didn't find a burglar, but they did open up a closet and find 37 pounds of pot in there. So, we're in a lot of trouble. Now, he's going to prison, that's all there is to it, because he's got a jacket this long, he's gone. I don't happen to have any prior drug charges, so my defense in the case was that it was for personal use. And I have a really bad problem with pot. And anyways, believe it or not, it actually worked. What I got out of that was I got a suspended 2-year prison sentence. And the reason why I wanted it, I wanted cultivation and possession is county jail time and sales is prison time. I don't want to do prison. As good as I look in orange, I don't want to do prison time. And so I can do county jail, and that's what I got. I got a 2-year suspended sentence, probation, and drug diversion to get me off pot. Because I clearly have a very serious pot problem, right? So off I go to diversion, and I'm happy to go there, happy to be there. Part of my diversion was I had to do 16 self-help meetings. Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, they don't care. And so I'm doing my diversion, and I was a nightmare for the poor counselors there. And he's in prison, so I'm having a great time. I mean, I don't have to answer to anybody, and I've got all the money that was stashed. It was best. It was great. I mean, I was on a roll when I got to AA. And so I've got about a week left before I have to meet with my PO for the first time, and I haven't been to a meeting yet. Because that's how I roll. And so I'm looking through the schedule, and I find that there's a 9 a.m. Sunday morning meeting at the Vista Entertainment Center, which is a place I actually drank. And I thought, oh, perfect. Right? I know exactly where that is. Little sidebar here. So I come walking into the meeting at about 9, 10 probably. And just to kind of give you a visual here, I was also into the punk scene a little bit. It was 1987. And I was also into, because he's gone now, so I'm staying up for several days in a row with a little assistance. And when you stay up for 3-4 days in a row, you start seeing stuff. But the stuff you're seeing is always right outside of your line of vision, you know? It's kind of right in your peripheral. And you turn and you look, and it's never there. It's like, I know, I saw it. It's not there. So I put together that it's my hair, right? I mean, that makes sense. So I shaved the sides of my head. And it was still there, but I kind of had this cool sort of a mohawk thing, kind of spiky and you know, black lipstick and pierced this and tattooed that and, you know, black leather and all this stuff. And I come walking into my first AA meeting looking like this, a vision for you. And I walk in the room late. There's a meeting going on. I look through the room, cowboys, cowgirls, jarheads, as far as the eye can see. Not a normal person in the whole place, right? Except for this one chick sitting over by the coffee bar. She had kind of this magenta red hair and this unbelievable makeup job and this really cool, you know, yellow and white striped knee socks and Converse. It's just like somebody normal looking to me. And there's people standing up in the front of the room, and the group is singing Happy Birthday, and there's kind of a Dolly Parton sort of a gal and a Merle Haggard sort of a guy up at the front, and he's like one of those big beer belt buckle guys, right? And Dolly's holding a cake with a big old 5 on it, and Merle's not 5. Merle's at least 50 if he's a day. And this is very confusing. This is very confusing for me. It's like there's weird people and they're doing weird stuff and there's one person over there. Anyways, so I go sit down next to this girl and meeting dies down. They were probably having a meeting or something. And I turn to her and I said, hey, my name's April. And she turns to me and she reaches out this lily white hand and she says, hi, my name's Michael. I'm an alcoholic. Cowboys, cowgirls, jarheads, crossdressers. Michael was 17. He was a year and a half sober. He was a blast. And he scooped me up and started taking me to meetings. We got all 16 of those meetings done before the first time I had to meet with my probation officer. And I lost touch with Michael the first year that I was hanging around AA, but I always like to say this, Michael, I don't know where you are, but wherever you are, thank you. He probably saved my life because he got me into this thing. So I loved AA right away, but I wasn't going to be sober for a while. Played around with this thing for another couple of years, met another Michael, and in a blackout one time, married him, and shouldn't have. I'd never been married before, but I mean, this is... I've never seen a sicker relationship in my life. And there's some sick relationships in AA, I got to tell you. But I've never seen a sicker one than this one. I've seen some as sick, but not. I mean, we were just violent and hostile and unbalanced. And you know, and it's not, I was not a battered woman. Let me put that out there right now. I mean, we would be in an argument and we would be screaming at each other. And I knew if I said one more word, I was going to get it. Or I would be looking at him, and I mean, the guy's 6'2", 240 pounds, right? And we're in this just heated argument, screaming at each other, and it would come into my mind that I can take him, right? I can take, and I, bam, and it's on. And this is the way, and so now I'd throw him out, and then I'd go get him. And bring him back. And this is what, and he was always kind of in one of the same places. And then one day, I couldn't find him. I threw him out, and now I can't find him. And I'm very upset by this, right? Because we kind of have an agreement here or an understanding about things. So I'm very upset about it. And I got, I thought, you know what? This is it. I'm done with this. I'm tired of this. And we're in and out of AA this whole time, too. If he's sober, I'm sober. If he's not sober, I'm not sober either. And we just kind of have this homicide-packed, weird relationship. So I decided, can't find him, what to do? What's a girl to do? And I decided to, I know, I'll sell my Suzuki, and I'll use the money, and I'm going to move to Maui, and I'm going to live in a tent. Plan A. Found out that the car wasn't worth what I owed on it, so plan A is not going to work. Plan B was eat a bottle of sleeping pills and drink a 12-pack. That's plan B. So I'm going to do myself in, which it obviously didn't work. But I ended up in the hospital, went in and got my stomach pumped and all that. And while I was in the hospital, apparently I had agreed to go someplace afterwards. I didn't know that you had to. For some reason, I thought you had to go to these places. So I ended up in they call it a crisis center. It's a loony bin. They can call it anything they want. It's a loony bin. And I ended up there with a 375-pound transvestite, a guy that was into self-mutilation, burns all over him, and a kid named Rob that he had Susan tattooed across his forehead in like inch-high letters like this, but he actually had it tattooed backwards so that when he looked in the mirror, it was spelled right. And these are my new best friends, and I can't understand why am I here with these people, and where's my medication? And while I'm in that place, he called on the payphone and asked me if I wanted to get married. Plan C. I didn't have anything else to do, actually. So got out of there, got drunk one more time, married Lumpy, and I've never had another drink since. So poor Lumpy had to sit in meetings with me for the next couple of years, me sharing that my wedding day was my bottom. And it was. And, you know, I mean, it was destined to fail. And it didn't, you know, I mean, we didn't make it or anything like that. But as was our pattern, you know, when we decided to get married, I thought, let's get sober, too. And so we're going to be sober in AA now. Oops, we got drunk one more time. Oops, you know, got married. And 3 weeks later, he got drunk again. And that was my cue to go get drunk with him. That's what I did. And I didn't want to. I just didn't want to. I mean, I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm so sick of doing this. And I went to an AA meeting instead. He went and got drunk, and I went to the Escondido Alano Club, which I'd been to the Alano Club many, many, many times. But this time I'm not following him. I'm going on my own behalf. And, yeah, and people had been trying to talk to me for a couple of years, and I wasn't really having it. That's not true. I would talk to the guys. I would not talk to the women. Very common for female alcoholics not to like other females, and I was one of them. And so, you know, people are trying to reach out and this and that, and I'm not really having it. But this one day, I was standing there holding up the wall one day, and this one woman comes walking up to me. She puts her hand out in front of me, and she says, "Hey, my name's Joni," like that. And I kind of try to ignore her and kind of just shift my body language a little bit. So she comes over into my line of vision again. She says, "Hey, my name's Joni." Most aggressive woman I've ever met in my life, right? And I'm trying to just dismiss her, and she's not having it. And she ended up being my best friend for the first year or two that I was sober. I mean, we were thick as thieves. Thank God she was as aggressive as she was, because I wouldn't have... She told me later on that the reason why she did that is because she felt sorry for me, because I was so fucking bizarre looking. Thank God for Joni. And we're off and running, and we're just being sober in AA, and just going to be sober in AA. And didn't get onto the steps right away. Didn't see the point. Probably wasn't alcoholic yet. I actually wasn't alcoholic until I was about 9 months sober. Remember, I got here on a court card. I got here on a hustle. But I liked it here, and I knew that something was off, and there was something bright and shiny about you guys, and I liked being here, and I seemed to fit here better than I'd ever fit anyplace else. And one day I was sitting there in a meeting, and I heard this guy up here sharing, and I'd probably heard exactly this, I don't know how many times in the last couple of years, but he was talking about the phenomenon of craving. And he somehow described it in a way that I got it. I got it. I mean, he was just talking about meaning to have a couple of drinks and ended up drunk. And you know what the truth of the matter is I've never in my life drank the way I wanted to drink. When I first started drinking, I was a kid, and I couldn't get it often enough, and I couldn't drink as much as I wanted to. By the time I was 21 and old enough to drink, I was drinking too much, and I was trying to drink less. I'd never drank like I wanted to drink. And I have this thing that if I get some alcohol in me, I'm off and running. And just the way that he described it, I got it. And that God that used to just terrify me blessed me with all of these memories of these times when I was just going to have a couple of drinks and have a little bit of fun. And 3 days later, or 6 o'clock in the morning, or whatever. And I didn't mean to. I didn't mean for that to happen. I don't drink like I mean to. I don't drink like I want to. And at that moment, I got alcoholism. Part of my first step right there. And shortly after that, I was going to launch on the steps. I got my first sponsor when I was about 90 days sober. And the reason why I asked Skippy to be my sponsor was because she touched me. And women like her didn't touch women like me. She's a real nice lady, right? And I mean, I'm just look like a freak. And I got up to share one day, and I'm walking past her, and she just kind of put her arms out like this for me to give her a hug, and I couldn't believe she was willing to touch me. You know, I mean, I know what kind of a woman I am. And I just, will you be my sponsor? And she said, yeah. And we didn't do any step work. I needed to do some pre-step work, apparently. I had a new idea every... I had a new idea every 13 minutes and 27 seconds, and I would call Skippy with these great ideas about this thing I wanted to do, and I would be running this idea past her. I remember one time calling her and asking her, trying to talk her into letting me do cold water rushes. And for those of you that are not familiar with what that is, it's when you take a little bit of cold water and you put it in a hypodermic needle and you inject it into your arm, and it gives you a little quib for a second there. And she says, why would you want to do that? I said, because it gives you a little quib for a second there. She says, no, you can't do that. I said, why? It's water. There's no I drink water. And I'm like really trying to get, see, it's just water. She said, why? And I said, it's the ritual. I miss the ritual of it. And she says, learn the Japanese tea ritual. No, you can't do it. And... you know, and I mean, I call her up with the newest problem, and I'd be trying to run it down to her, and, you know, I mean, I'm right in the middle of this serious story, and I'm just, like, spun out of my mind, and right in the middle of a sentence, she says, did you make your bed today? Interrupted me. Rude. Right? And I went, no, why would I do that, you know? She says, I want you to go make your bed. Click. So I'm... really, man, she has no idea how dangerous I am, clearly. So I'm pacing, and I'm thinking, and I'm like, how long do you think it takes to make a bed, actually? And so I waited 10 minutes. I thought, better make it 11. Called her back, and she says, did you make your bed? And I said, yeah. She says, you're a flaming liar. Click. So I made the bed, and it takes 3 minutes. That's probably how she busted me. And called her back. And I said, she says, do you make your bed? And I said, yes, I did. And she said, did you really make your bed? And I said, yes, I did. And she says, okay. Silence. And I said, and? You're going to tell me what that's about? She says, yeah, I'll tell you what that's about. She says, your life's a mess. I went, I know. I'm trying to tell you about it. She says, you got a lot of problems. I'm like, I'm trying to tell you about my... She says, they are complicated problems. I went, I know. I'm trying to tell you this. And she says, how are you ever going to straighten any of that out when you can't even make your bed? Start small, princess. And she did have a point. So she'd have me clean things, and she'd have me sort things out, and she'd have me do this, and she'd have me do that, and she had me memorize the first page of the big book for 30 days. It took me a while to figure out which first page she was talking about. She's talking about this one. She said, you need to unlearn some stuff before there's going to be any room to learn anything, so just clear your brain, princess. And so she was kind of like my Mr. Miyagi, you know, wax on, wax off. And then I hooked up with Michaeline at about a year and a half sober, and I don't recommend waiting that long, but, you know, it takes as long as it takes, and she launched me right into the steps. Did the third step on accident. I didn't mean to. And she kind of tricked me and said, you know, you're late. Go home, and I want you to start writing on that fourth step. I'll give you a week to get it done. Had a date to get back to her house, and... I mean, I wasn't going to tell her everything. I don't know about you guys, but there was stuff I was not going to tell her. I wrote it down in code, but I was not going to tell her. And so we get there, and we pray together, and she said, do you have any questions? And I just blurted those first two things out right off the bat, and I wasn't going to. It's like God just kind of went, and there they popped out, you know? And she said the weirdest thing. She went, yeah, me too. And she's like a soccer mom from La Mesa, you guys. I mean, she does not look like she... Uh-huh. And throughout that fifth step, she kept up with me, neck and neck. I would share something scandalous, and she would say she'd either done it or done something like it or thought about it. She fell asleep through my sexual inventory. I don't have a resentment about that anymore. Dozed off. She finally says, I mean, I'm like into the whole telling her all about it. She finally says, stop. She says, is the rest of it pretty much like that? And I said, well, yeah. She says, can we just call the rest of them John and move on? And I went, yeah, actually. And so my fifth step, I didn't have a spiritual experience or this sense of freedom or anything like that. My fifth step was kind of like the first time I ever had sex. It was... kind of painful, and it was really embarrassing, and it wasn't what I expected, and I was mostly just glad when it was over with. So. But I went home and I did what I was supposed to do. I took the book down off the shelf, and I considered what the work that I'd done so far, and I prayed the prayer. And the next day when I went to a meeting, I was in AA. I walked into that meeting, and I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I even had this kind of weird fantasy that there's the step-taken people, and there's the not-yet-taken-the-steps people. And I'm one of the step-taken people. Like, I could tell them from the other. It's like, it was just crazy. But I really felt a part of something. And, man, right? 6 and 7's been an ongoing thing. I don't know about you guys, but 6 and 7 is just something that you repeat doing. And my ninth step was insurmountable. There was absolutely no way that I could accomplish everything that I needed to accomplish with my ninth step. And I'm here to tell you that it's all cleaned up. It's all cleaned up. I learned that with God, all things are possible. With God, there's nothing that can't be done, that can't be fixed, that can't be cleaned up. Paid back every dime that I owed, have done some healing with my family. I get the privilege of sponsoring some folks here, practice my prayer and meditation, and do everything that I can to try and stay in the middle of this deal. I believe I'm sober because of God's grace. I also believe I'm sober because I don't drink no matter what. No matter what. And I think that that is really important, but I think the likelihood of my not drinking no matter what improves greatly if I'm right in the middle of this thing. I see alcoholism as a predator, and any predator will pick the ones off the fringes, the sick and the weak, and my job is to stay in the middle of this thing as much as I can. The step process, if you're nervous about them, start at one, and it takes a really long time to get to the scary ones. And while you're doing them, one prepares you for two, and two encourages you to do three, and then three gives you the strength to do four is the reason why you do five, and then on to six and seven, which straightens some stuff out, and then you get into eight, which prepares you for nine, and so on and so on and so on. That's been my experience. So I don't have to be afraid of it. What I'm doing now is going to prepare me for the next thing that I need to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're somebody who's a little bit frightened about it, where's Jared? Yeah. Jordan, thank you. Can you change your name to Jared, please? I like Jared. I hate mistakes. You know what you were talking about the steps, and you can't know this side of them what it's going to be like on that side of them. It says right there, having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. And that's what we're promised here. That's all we're promised here is a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. That's all you're going to get out of it. But that in itself is everything. It's everything. I'm going to wrap it up with just a little story. Actually, kind of almost a little nag about something. When we were talking at the beginning of the meeting, I've been hearing this in a lot of meetings about, you know, asking for a little bit more support. And I first started coming to meetings in 1987. And a pack of cigarettes was under a dollar in 1987. And a gallon of gas was under a dollar in 1987. And I was throwing a dollar in the basket. And times have changed. So it seems reasonable that AA and the Seventh Tradition should probably keep up with the times that have changed. So dig deep. You know, AA's worth it. It's a, you know, we need to be able to contribute to Central. We need to be able to contribute to AA as a whole, and we need to be able to keep this thing open for the next guy. I got nieces, nephews, and grandkids that need to come here. And I want this thing to be intact, and I want it to be available. So I'm asking you, do what you can, okay? We stopped off at Starbucks on the way here, and what was a cup of coffee? About $4? Probably about $9 at Starbucks. So anyways, that's my little chastisement or whatever, or my little plea or my little appeal. You know what, you guys, thank you so much for having me. I had a good time. Thanks.